Hey everyone, it's Jalian. The pandemic triggered a major housing crisis, resulting in millions of renters and unhoused people across the country becoming at risk for being evicted or displaced. Meanwhile, those living in apartments with mold or pests have been stuck with environmental conditions that exacerbate asthma and COVID-19. In St. Louis, tenants and housing advocates are pushing back by advocating for eviction moratoriums, holding landlords accountable, and working to create a tenant's bill of rights. On May 1st, I joined a small but mighty group of canvassers for a sunny walk through a tree-lined neighborhood in South St. Louis City. They were distributing flyers and spreading awareness of a local effort to create a tenant's bill of rights on behalf of Homes for All St. Louis, which is part of a national movement to defend and expand affordable housing. Here's Sharon Jones, the group's Tenants' Bill of Rights organizer, explaining to a South City resident some of the protections in the proposed Tenants' Bill of Rights.
Full disclosure is a big one for me because, like, it requires that you talk about anything that's happened in the apartment. So, like, what if there was mold and you didn't know? What if there were bugs and you didn't know? The landlord should be disclosing this information. And further than that, landlords should just be disclosing, like, how much you pay in utilities. Because, like, I remember I had this apartment that was, like, $600-something, mm-hmm. but the utilities were, like, $300-$400.
Right, it's almost a little false advertising there.
It almost
is. You're paying $1,000.
Because I'm basically paying $1,000, not paying $500 or however much it was. And then the last one is free reporting, which is a good one, because it means that if you report your landlord can't retaliate against you.
That seems important.
That seems very important. Yeah. Because we have landlords who are out here who are like targeting folks and like, you know, retaliating against folks just for
sticking up for themselves.
Exactly.
I'm sure
we don't want
happens
that.
Happens a lot.
Yeah. So now that I've done that, would you be willing to sign one of these pledge cards in support for Tenants' Bill of Rights?
Yeah, this sounds like a great idea.
Excellent, thank you. So take that. That's the pledge card. Here's a marker, because I like markers. How many did I give you? Oh, just
this
one.
This was just the one I had this
card. Excellent. So if you don't mind putting your John Hancock there.
Okay.
This was Homes for All St. Louis's second day of canvassing about the Tenants' Bill of Rights, and Sharon looks forward to taking the effort citywide.
When you talk to folks about a Tenants' Bill of Rights, first, most folks are like, wait, what's that? And then folks who are like, who do know what it is, are like, yes, we want to see a Tenants' Bill of Rights. Excellent. I don't love to educate people about how few rights folks have, but I do like talking to people about the fact that we need more rights in St. Louis City. Making people aware of what the issue is so we can rectify the issue, mm-hmm. or at least get to a point where we start to like try to rectify the issue, which is a lack of protections on the part of tenants.
It's not just renters like Sharon who are getting involved. Joshua Lawrence, another canvasser, is a homeowner and former landlord who says that a person's ability to access quality housing shouldn't be determined by their zip code.
In the part of my neighborhood that I live in, we have a lot of illegal dumping, right? And the people who are dumping aren't the people who live there, right? It is the contractors, it is the developers who don't want to pay the extra funds to actually go dispose of their stuff. It's just saying, oh, okay, well, we know that this area where, you know, the poors live, we don't care, we're just going to throw it out and be done with it, right? And candidly, that's environmental racism, right? Like, even though, you know, I am white, I benefit from all of these things, I'm not oblivious to what's going on in my neighborhood. You know, so obviously racism doesn't affect, like, it does affect me personally because I benefit from it. But at the same time, when you benefit from something, you have to call it out for what it is. You can't just, if you stand by and just go, oh, you know, it is what it is, but I'm gonna reap all these benefits. Like, no, it's screwed up. You gotta call it out for what it is. And you know, I know everybody hates the phrase, but acknowledge privilege and say, here's what we can do to actually get others into a better spot.
As As Sharon, Joshua, and other tenants' rights advocates canvass for protections, government leaders and property owners are still making decisions that can set their efforts back overnight. On May 5th, a federal judge vacated a nationwide CDC eviction moratorium, which was set to expire on June 30th. Then, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a notice of appeal, resulting in a temporary administrative stay on the order, so that the eviction moratorium remains in effect across the country, for now. But local housing advocates believe that housing is a human right, and that access to quality, affordable housing shouldn't be constantly subject to change. So in this episode, we hear more from Sharon and two other members of State Street Tenants Resistance about the stories and lived experiences that motivate them to advocate for a tenant's Bill of Rights. And an organizer from a local community development corporation will explain how to hold problem landlords accountable and what's at stake when large companies and the state need to be held accountable too. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. Back in 2017, Sharon was getting fed up with the conditions of her apartment.
I had a problem with pests. I had a problem with mold. I had a problem with water leakage, and I had a problem with garbage. There was two bushes in front of my apartment, in front of the fourplex. There was constantly debris under there. There was broken glass on the back steps.
She began talking to Maisha Johnson, a tenant organizer who was trying to bring the Homes for All movement to St. Louis.
We started in conversation around issues that we were having with our landlord, and then realized we had the same landlord who was the slumlord. We started discussing and what issues we were having in our homes and how we felt that they needed to be addressed. And also the landlord needed to be held accountable for the conditions of the properties that he continued to rent out.
They met other tenants like Sarah Watkins, who had bad experiences with the same landlord.
I had transitioned from blaming myself for my conditions and was finally starting to understand like the bigger picture around housing in St. Louis and why certain neighborhoods look the way they do. My friend and I, we were roommates, and we were naturally organizing and finding information and researching and talking to other tenants and not really understanding that that is how you build a tenant union.
Their shared experiences motivated them to become the three working members of State Street Tenant Resistance, a tenant union located in South St. Louis City.
Our hope is that tenant unions would blossom everywhere in all neighborhoods, and that people will talk to their neighbors, talk to the people closest to them, and find connections to issues that they have and take those issues to the creator.
Sharon remembers visiting a young mother of four children.
You can see the cracks in the walls. You can see like the remnants of pests. You can see the chipping away of paint. Without any hesitation, she invited me in her home with her children to go through these conditions that she was in. And the first thing that blew my mind was how inviting she was. The second thing that blew my mind was that she was experiencing the same things that I experienced and was willing to show me what was going on.
She says that's because landlords often use intimidation to discourage their tenants from speaking up.
We can tell that there are certain things that are going on in their apartment that shouldn't be going on, and that there are things that need to be fixed. And they tell us, no, everything's okay. But that's because they fear that the landlord will kick them out, which is a real thing. Or they fear that the landlord will retaliate in other ways or just not do anything at all.
Sarah has witnessed both retaliation and inaction from landlords.
The landlords will call the police on tenants. They'll take your persistence as aggression, especially as a Black woman. Just me just being persistent and wanting to get things fixed, you see that as a threat because I won't go away.
Sarah adds that out-of-state landlords might use property managers to shield themselves from tenant complaints.
They lived in Hawaii. bought the unit and had owned it for about 6 months before even seeing it. And I had done my research and learned all this and, you know, had even tried to reach out to the property owner to get certain things fixed. And instead of talking to me, they would talk to the property manager and just continue that cycle of nothingness.
It can be even harder to hold landlords who use multiple shell companies accountable.
If you're operating under one name and people start giving you bad reviews, you have a terrible BBB rating. If you just change your name and put a slap a new sticker on it, then no one knows. You know, it's harder to connect those dots in that history.
But low-income tenants who have poor credit, past evictions, or criminal history are unable to shake their past, making them even more vulnerable to problem landlords who want to collect rent without making necessary repairs. When the pandemic came, tenants fell into an even more precarious position.
The moratorium doesn't protect all tenants. There's still loopholes and reasons that a landlord can find to get someone out.
St. Louis City eviction moratoriums were piecemeal, had multiple extensions, and only applied to the last step of the eviction process. In contrast, the national 3-month-long CDC eviction moratorium applied to all steps of the eviction process, as long as a tenant filled out a form that states that they didn't make over $99,000 a year or receive a stimulus check, couldn't make housing payments because of income loss or large medical bills, and that they would be unhoused or forced to live with family or shelters if they lost their home. On top of that, they needed to show that they applied for government assistance for rent or housing and paid as much rent as possible.
So there are already evictions piling up. And then when you leave this window of time of uncertainty and for things to open back up and keep going, the landlords are rushing to evict people. And the sheriff will tell you that, you know, a lot of people are making calls and asking what they can do. And evictions are still going on if with a judgment or without a judgment. Landlords will take it upon themselves to like change the locks or shut off utilities or just make it so a tenant will have to leave.
Maisha points out that the staggering number of evictions is especially troubling in a city where eviction is twice as common among renters in majority Black areas than renters in majority white areas.
Why is eviction dockets mostly filled with Black and brown women? How do we dismantle that? Why is it that they're the target in... How do we show up without being angry? Because the reason we show up angry is because we feel we're never heard. We're overlooked and they pat us on their head and say, it's okay. It's not okay. It's not okay that our children are the ones that is affected by the asthma, by the lead, by the environmental issues that not only show up on the outside, but inside our homes where we're supposed to be safe and feel secured. Let's break that stigma, because it's not that we're angry Black women. We're women that want our families to be safe and secured in their space.
State Street Tenant Resistance and other local housing advocates took legal action, hosted rallies, held press conferences, and created petitions to stop illegal lockouts and call for eviction and utility moratoriums. Last April, they participated in a statewide car protest against evictions. But when I interviewed them in early March, Sharon said that things hadn't gotten better.
Because we're starting to see more illegal evictions. We're starting to see landlords take it upon themselves to change locks, to kick people out, to threaten folks that they're going to kick them out for the most asinine of reasons. So things are staying the same in the sense that, like, we have these moratoriums that are in place for a month, and then they're put in place for another month. So these, like, piecemeal responses to the pandemic and housing. And then we have illegal evictions that are occurring at like a large rate. So things are staying the same or they're getting worse.
Meanwhile, Sharon, Maisha, and Sarah are continuing to educate tenants about their rights on Facebook Live and at the doors.
No, the tenant is not at fault. You're not at fault for the building deteriorating. You're not at fault for the high electric bills. You're not at fault for the paint chipping, the mold in the home, the lead, whatever it is going on with that building, you're not at fault. That's the landlord's responsibility. And there are other entities that you can reach out to. such as EHOC, Equal Housing Opportunity Council, Arch City Defenders. They have housing lawyers now, and legal services. Those are the spaces that you can reach out to see if you can get assistance with legal representation. Because a lot of times the landlord will say, well, it's your fault, or you have to fix it. No, it's their property. And if it isn't in the lease, then it is their responsibility to handle that.
They're motivated by their victories in holding problem landlords accountable for conditions such as faulty electrical wiring, sewage and basements, inaccessible stairs, pests, leaks, and mold.
He was a landlord who would abuse like the LLC names and hide and just make different shell companies, so it's hard to track. But we found him and we put pressure on him and eventually got him to move from the building he was operating out of, which I think about it every day, really, because I walk past it and I see the sign that says, you know, the mail is no longer coming to this address for his business. I mean, but the other part of that is now we have to find him again, you know.
They're also driven by their success in holding utility companies accountable for high energy costs. When Maisha realized she was paying more for utilities than rent, she contacted her friend, Leah Clyburn, the Beyond Coal organizer for the Missouri chapter of the Sierra Club.
We compared our bills. My bill was three times the amount of hers, and she just lives a few blocks, like five, six blocks west of me. And so I compared it with another person. I was like, this isn't right. So as Sierra Club started pushing back on Ameren on how they do their market rate and the extra charges that they put on folks in the black and brown zip codes, that they needed to change that and revamp how they show up in those communities. There's been more programs and the rates have been lowered, but we continue to see in those communities that those bills are still higher than other spaces.
They're hoping to prevent housing inequities by following the example of other cities where tenants have proactively organized for protections.
Kansas City has a tenant's bill of rights. They have an office that deals with tenant complaints and tenant issues specifically that came from their tenant bill of rights being passed as a resolution. We have cities like Oakland that have passed just cause statutes. And just cause means that the landlord can't kick you out just because they want to. They have to have a specific reason to evict you. So places like New York City have just cause evictions. They have rent control. So there are other cities that have loads more protections than we do in St. Louis. Like landlords can come in the apartment whenever they want to. Landlords can retaliate against organizing. Landlords can evict people with limited notice. Like, there's a lot of things landlords can do in St. Louis that they can't do in other cities.
With Homes for All St. Louis, they've come up with 10 clauses for a proposed tenant's bill of rights based on protections won in other states.
Certain parts of the tenant's bill of rights that we want to see is no retaliation for organizing. We want to see rent caps and we want to see fee caps so that folks aren't paying like more than first and last month's rent for a deposit, but maybe only the first month's rent for the deposit. We want to see just cause on it. So we want to make sure that people are evicted for only specific reasons.
I would add right to counsel, because landlords have and property managers have attorneys when they show up to housing court, and a lot of times a tenant does not, and they might get a deal or agree to something that is more hurtful than helpful to them. Banning the eviction box on rental applications, because we know if an eviction on your record makes it almost impossible sometimes to find housing after that. Yeah, and I think also criminal history too, banning that question.
Their hope is to get the Tenants' Bill of Rights passed as legislation through the St. Louis City Board of Aldermen.
We can hold the Aldermanic Board accountable. Like, they can make change. They just need the right folks pushing them. And community needs to be a part of a lot of the conversations of what change looks like in their area, because what it looks like in my area may not look like change in your area.
For me personally, I think that politics and policy and budgeting has been so removed from the people, and that we see City Hall and our leaders as these, I don't know, godly beings that are just over the rest of us. And that's not it. That's not what it's supposed to be. They are supposed to represent us. We represent them, vice versa. And that's why I fight, because I want to change that perception. And I want to help people understand that we are powerful, but we have to do it together. And I do it for my son, because I know these issues, if we don't fight now, then it's gonna just be worse for the next generation. We have to teach people, including our kids, you know, what's right and how to get what we deserve.
What Sarah said, so my children and my grandchildren don't have to continue the struggle that I've lived and that my mother and grandmother has lived. I come from a family of fighters, and to change the dialogue that it's the renter's fault of the way they're living and the experience that they're having. And also just showing community that they hold the power to make change in their community and how to lift their voices up and be heard.
My absolute anger sustains me. My like disdain for folks having to live in deplorable conditions keeps me going. And also what keeps me going is the fact that like we can win, the fact that we can get to the place where everyone in St. Louis has safe, affordable, dignified housing. We're seeing that sustains me. The fact that we have had wins, the fact that I met Maisha and Sarah, like these are the things that sustain me personally and make me want to continue to do the work. And seeing that, and seeing the light bulb go off in tenants' heads, like, oh, wait a minute, you're right, none of this is my fault, or you're right, I should be organizing with other people, that sustains me as well.
State Street tenants' resistance came from a deep well of frustration among tenants like Sharon, Sarah, and Maisha. It also arose from community empowerment meetings held by a local community development corporation. So up next, we learn about how local community meetings help educate tenants about how to hold problem landlords accountable and inform residents about polluters in their neighborhood. To help us understand how community meetings can help educate tenants on their rights and inform them about polluters in their neighborhood, we spoke to Carissa Gilman Hernandez, community empowerment organizer at Dutchtown South Community Corporation.
Community Development Corporation is a remnant of a HUD program. I believe we've been here for about 50 years now. We are publicly funded as well as privately funded organizations that focus on developing the communities around us. So Dutchtown South serves Dutchtown, Marine Villa, Mount Pleasant, and Gravois Park.
Those neighborhoods contain over 28,000 residents, with over a third of households living below the poverty line and over half of households being low to moderate income. Many areas are over 50% Black, with close to a third of residents being white and the rest of the residents being Latino, Asian, Native American, other race, or multiracial.
I believe it's important for everybody to get involved in environmental justice work. With Dutchtown South, we got really involved in it because our community was really concerned. And what they were seeing was the direct impacts of generations of decisions the city has made. And that was what was really concerning. But the more we learned about it, the more we saw that it was part of a greater pattern.
Residents were most concerned about vacancies and illegal dumping.
Our alleyways were just not clean. They were unsafe. There's trash being dumped constantly, tires, broken glass. Pickups were not frequent. There was a lack of dumpster space, recycling, things like that. And so we applied for a grant with the EPA for the So Fresh, So Clean, So Creative. And with that funding, what we did was we started doing some deep research into what was happening in our alleyways and really getting a sense of what's happening in St. Louis in general when it comes to solid waste and how that's handled. But we also were able to do our community champions program through that as well. And so these are community members who are committed to a safer and cleaner environment. And so they host cleanups, education events. We have done large art projects in the past with the trash we've collected. They kind of think through different ways to get people involved and kind of lead the direction of how we want to address illegal dumping and solid waste in our immediate community.
But Carissa points out that vacancies and illegal dumping are just some of the more visible effects of structural racism and systemic disinvestment.
We really can't address those without addressing the fact that there's high mold in the buildings in our area, that there's lead paint, there's lead in the pipes in our schools. And so kids are drinking lead water. And you really can't, you know, address all of that without really looking at like, where are the grocery stores? What are people eating? What options do they have? Once you start looking at individual pieces of that environmental justice work, you just see that it's connected to everything else. And so it's important that we not just address like one or two items, but really take it from a holistic approach.
That means treating resident concerns as part of larger patterns that can be addressed through education, advocacy, or systemic change.
A tenant will notice that there is mold in their apartment, and they will address it with the landlord. And the landlord will either tell them like, oh, we fixed it, or they might get evicted because they're causing problems. And the landlord kind of uses this as a way to get them out of their house, or will refuse to renew their lease if there is an issue like that. What we're seeing is that landlords are painting over the mold without actually addressing the problem. And so a new tenant will move in and say, oh my gosh, this is a freshly painted apartment. Everything is great. They move in and then the problem just happens all over again. Or if it's still the same tenant and the landlord just said, oh, we fixed it, but really they just put a fresh coat of paint over it, it'll take a little bit for that tenant to see the problem come back. And then they're starting from ground zero with this landlord all over again.
Community organizers like Carissa can connect tenants with legal services to demand action from landlords or help them navigate how to get their concerns addressed in other ways, such as a rent strike, which rose in popularity during the pandemic.
In Missouri, I want to say, I believe this is a statewide thing, not just city, but you have to live inside a building for 6 months before you can like deduct your rent for maintenance issues that like maybe you covered it yourself. You call, you know, they didn't fix it, so I just brought in a handyman and they fixed it for me, and I'm going to bill, for lack of a better word, my landlord for it. You can do that, but you have to live there for 6 months, and there's specific parameters that you have to like give your landlord time to get that issue taken care of themselves. But if somebody is going to go on a rent strike, I always recommend that they talk to lawyers first. And it's not just, I didn't pay my rent this month and my landlord is going to like feel that. What it really is you put that money into a secure account that the city acknowledges, an escrow account. And so what you're showing the city and a judge potentially is that I'm willing to pay my rent. I want to pay my rent because I'm living in this location, but the item is not habitable. These things are not being taken care of. And until they're taken care of, my rent is going to go into this account and my landlord will not get it until these issues are addressed.
In addition to educating tenants on their rights, Carissa has found herself in the position of informing tenants about state-level decisions that could affect their quality of life when Dutchtown South Community Corporation received communication from Great Rivers Environmental Law Center, a Missouri-based public interest law firm focused on the environment and public health.
They reached out to Dutchtown South to let us know that we had a pretty large pollutant in our footprint, the Kinder Morgan facility.
The Kinder Morgan Transmix Terminal is a loading facility for gasoline and fuel oil products. It can emit volatile organic compounds, hazardous air pollutants, and particulate matter, which can irritate the eyes and respiratory system, cause headaches and dizziness, visual disorders, and memory impairment, and are associated with cancer.
There is a weird smell in our area that happens on different days. And so, you know, if it's not the Kinder Morgan facility, it's another facility, but people don't trust that air. They don't feel safe and confident having that facility in their area.
Great Rivers Environmental Law Center informed Dutchtown South Community Corporation that Kinder Morgan had applied for a permit renewal with the Missouri Department of Natural Resources, or MDNR, and requested to speak to residents at one of Dutchtown South's community empowerment meetings.
And then a pandemic hit. And so that, you know, kind of pushed back a little bit. We were eventually able to get them on a Zoom meeting, and they kind of laid down like pollutants that were coming from Kinder Morgan facility. And they talked about the health concerns related to it. And they were like, you know, they're applied for this permit and they actually didn't follow the procedures that they're supposed to in reaching out to the community. They were like, we've already, you know, told the state this, and we're going to wait for the state to either refuse the permit and say, no, you need to go follow the EPA guidelines of community involvement. Or if the state does issue the permit, then we will file a complaint with the EPA. And so they laid out all of the ways that could happen. And so we just kind of waited and waited. And then they reached out to us again and said, well, the permit got issued, so we would like to file a complaint to the EPA on behalf of Dutchtown South and the NAACP of St. Louis. So what I did was I had them speak again at our Community Empowerment Committee meeting, and they answered questions. And then we sent out a poll essentially to community members and said, you know, would you like Dutchtown South to sign on to this complaint or not? So it was a unanimous decision. Nobody voted against it. And so we signed on.
So on September 4th, 2020, attorneys Bob Manise and Sarah Rubenstein of the Great Rivers Environmental Law Center filed an administrative complaint to the federal EPA and Office of Civil Rights on behalf of the Missouri State and St. Louis City NAACP and Dutchtown South Community Corporation under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The complaint alleged discrimination by the Missouri Department of Natural Resources, or MDNR, in its March 10, 2020 issuance of an operating permit to Kinder Morgan. Great Rivers Environmental Law Center also worked with Dutchtown South to create and distribute flyers about the complaint, pollutants, and tenant rights, along with contact information for legal assistance.
We canvassed the immediate neighborhood around the Kinder Morgan facility. I picked, you know, four blocks, and I just went around and we dropped these flyers at all these houses so people knew more about it. And when we were having events, we would hand those out.
But Carissa wishes that instead of having to inform residents about the complaint after the Kinder Morgan permit was already issued, that MDNR would proactively seek community involvement in the permitting process.
It's disrespectful to those who live here to think that it's okay to pollute the air and water and to not explain what's happening, to ignore health concerns. If it's truly safe, if it's truly not a problem, then that would be the easiest thing in the world to explain. And that would be easy to say, like, this is what these chemicals are and this is how they interact with the human body and you shouldn't be worried. And instead, it's secretive and it's behind closed doors and there's not any involvement. And so if people are afraid, if they're scared, if they don't trust, then that's on the people who issued that permit. That's on the people who asked for the permit. And it's just, it's disrespectful of the citizens. It's disrespectful of taxpayers who are the ones that keep those departments open for the state and the city and the government and the federal government. It makes me angry and it makes me sad and hurt for so many people that are being disrespected like that. they're going to have to be the ones that put in the work to make that trust happen again. And so they're going to be the ones that have to figure out a way to either acknowledge what they are putting into our air and what impact it could have on people's health, short-term and long-term. And they're going to have to put in the work on how to combat any ill side effects of what they are putting into our air and to our water. Be that by offering to, you know, put money towards air home filters or planting trees in the neighborhoods or other things that they could possibly be doing. But they have broken the trust. And I believe that any of the other pollutants in our area who apply to get these permits, who aren't doing that due diligence of letting folks know what chemicals they're putting out there and what the side effects may be from those chemicals, are the ones that have broken our trust. And so it's up to them to work to regain it. I want to see an environment where people can be outdoors. I want to see an environment where people want to be outdoors, where there's lots of trees and there's lots of green spaces, and you can trust the air is healthy around you. And that if you wanted to walk or bike or, you know, just take a bus to easily get somewhere, you can. You don't need to necessarily hop in your car. And just to create that space where kids can ride their bikes. And we have lots of parks that are well, like, taken care of. And, you know, it's just everybody has that option to be outdoors and to enjoy the outdoors.
The EPA has since issued a preliminary finding regarding the administrative complaint filed by Great Rivers Environmental Law Center on behalf of the Missouri and St. Louis City NAACP and Dutchtown South Community Corporation. Attorneys Sarah Rubenstein and Bob Manise will explain that finding in part two of this two-part series and what it means for the rest of Missouri in the next episode of We Live Here, so make sure you're subscribed to the podcast. This show is produced by me, Jialian Yang, and my co-producer, Lauren Brown. St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.